Let's say you just bought a house. Bad news is, you're one step closer to becoming your parents. You'll proudly mow the lawn, ask if anybody noticed you mowed the lawn, tell people to stay off the lawn, compare it to your neighbor's lawn, and complain about having to mow the lawn again. Good news is, it's easy to bundle home and auto through Progressive and save on your car insurance, which, of course, will go right into the lawn. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company, affiliates, and other insurers. Discount not available in all states or situations.
I can't believe it.
That Gerald is presenting the quarterly budget report with finger puppets?
Look, here comes a 1.7% decrease in fixed overhead. Hello, everybody.
No, I can't believe how easy it was to save hundreds of dollars on my car insurance with Geico.
Who are you? The projected increase in organic Q3 revenue. Hooray!
Believe it. Geico could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
I am not programmed for babysitting.
Everyone has been destroyed because of this freak. I won't allow it! These babies just saved this lame death party!
Let's say you just bought a house. Bad news is, you're one step closer to becoming your parents. You'll proudly mow the lawn, ask if anybody noticed you mowed the lawn, tell people to stay off the lawn, compare it to your neighbor's lawn, and complain about having to mow the lawn again. Good news is, it's easy to bundle home and auto through Progressive and save on your car insurance, which, of course, will go right into the lawn. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company, affiliates, and other insurers. Discount not available in all states or situations.
No! I always say, hey, jump, stop!
Autobots, roll out!
Hey guys, what's going on? You are listening to Twig, otherwise known as the flagship of stupidity, only on ThisWeekInGeek.net. I am one of your hosts this week, Mike the Birdman Dodd, but I'm not alone as we record over Discord. We're trying something new this time. I am joined with...
Alex.
So, we're trying something new this week because, once again, we have encountered Snowmageddon here in southern Ontario, where it is currently minus 35.
With wind.
School so buses are canceled.
I was going to say, it's not deathly cold immediate, but if you get out there and you don't have anything covering your face, you're done.
Yeah, pretty much it is. Well, my wife was out in it earlier this morning, and it was death cold. And, I'm glad she doesn't have to go out again today. So... thankful for that. So that's why you're listening to our podcast in the warmth of your home, perhaps the warmth of your car, the bus ride, the subway, wherever you are. Hopefully you are nice and toasty warm and not cold like some other poor schmucks who might have to, and unfortunately, work in this weather, which would be terrible.
Oh, exactly.
I hope you're well compensated regardless.
You should be.
So, as an update to last week, Alex, you have a little bit of something, but I'm going to give you guys my 30-second review of a movie I watched this week. Now, normally, I don't like to send in coverage for things that I really hate, and this is why I'm going to do it right here, right now, simply because it's so over the top. I watched the movie The Nun on the weekend. And I am a big fan of the Conjuring movies. I like Conjuring 1, Conjuring 2, Annabelle 1 sucks, Annabelle 2 creation is fucking stupid. And wouldn't you know, the tradition continues of fucking stupid. Me and Blair were watching this movie, and while it does seem like this is someone's Ravenloft fanfic, it ties so loosely to the Conjuring universe as to be, why did you fucking bother? And this was what I'd like to call jump scare the movie. Me and Blair are sitting there like, all right, 3, 2, 1. Ah, scary monster. Oh, yeah. And Alex, you've heard of the Conjuring movies, how they're more about paranormal investigation than ghosts and shit, right?
I have. I'm like, here's the thing. I love horror movies. I am not a jump scare person. I love like The Thing is a good example. There might be one or two jumps, but they're not intended, like the whole purpose of the movie is not just to constantly startle you. Like people mistake horror movies with startling movies. Horror movies should be horrific in imagery, horrific in what it makes you think. It shouldn't be just, you know, peekaboo all the time.
Yeah, this one, instead of making the threat subtle, as in a ghost can't really hurt you. It can scare you. It might be able to startle you. Maybe if it's powerful, it might be able to hurt you a little bit by scratching you or something. You know, the threat is supposed to be more psychological than anything. No, the nun has fucking zombies in it at one point. And one of the comeback lines is this demon, literally a demon named Varric or Valak. I can't even remember. It was like, "You are going to die, Frenchman." And this guy, and the character's name, I couldn't fucking believe it. I went with Frenchie. He's like, "I am French Canadian." I'm like, fuck off. It was so stupid. And somehow the deus ex machina of this movie was the blood of Jesus Christ. I'm not even kidding.
Because, of course, I saw the preview for it, like the movie trailer, and I was like, this is going to be jump scare the movie, like back when I saw like in theaters. And like, I was like, no.
Not everything needs to be franchised. And the problem is with the Conjuring movies, they take the parts of the movies that are meant to be scary as an offshoot, and they franchise them for no fucking reason. Anyway, end rant. Fuck the nun. Don't waste your money. If it's on Netflix or cable and you're really bored, why the hell not? I'm not even going to dignify where you can find this movie. Fuck it.
It was probably like one of those things where they'll make money putting it on Netflix, but they're like, hey, it's dirt cheap. Maybe we can make some money throwing it in theaters.
It made money in theaters, and that's the sad thing, because it had the Conjuring name attached to it. Anyway, yeah. Alex, you have an update to your drama from last week.
I do. So, my place started flooding, but not in my place. In the hallway, there is the main connector to the city's main line that goes into the building. Basically, every apartment building or every basement has to have an access point where they can, you know, couple lines together and access the main line if they ever have to. And it turns out it's just in the hallway outside of my apartment. I come back from recording new episodes of the Cambridge Chronicles with you and Tristan. And, you know, I come in, I'm putting down groceries, but I get down the stairs. I'm like, there's water. Oh, God, it overflowed. So I open up my apartment door, and it's in about a foot and a half into my place. Just about half an inch of water on the ground. But I go into the kitchen, and half of my kitchen is, like, submerged.
Oh.
Yeah, and, like, just three or four days earlier, we had had an electrician come in, like I mentioned, and it was repairing the wall socket for the stove. Had he not come and repaired that and put it mounted it properly on the wall,
this place
could have been on fire. Like, or,
and you don't have renter's insurance either.
No, I don't. not just that. Like, well, because the thing is, it would never been an issue before. but it wasn't just that. It was like, sure, there's fuses that, you know, the stove could turn off or whatever, but if the wiring and all that isn't grounded properly and it's literally physically not connected right, then who knows what could have happened. So you know, needless to say, contact the landlord actually happened to be apparently in the building an hour earlier, showing off the apartment upstairs to the new superintendent that was going to be moving in. And there was nothing. Like, it came down, showed the apartment, there was nothing there. So literally within like 10 minutes of him leaving and then me coming like 10 minutes after that, that's when all the flooding happened. So he was nearly on the highway, turned around, and it took four or five of us with buckets and stuff trying to empty out that drainage area. So what it turns out is there is a little pinprick hole or something in the main line from the city, because the pipes are like 60 years old. And it had slowly been a little trickle, and that's what they were trying to get managed last week. And it must have opened up a little more because of the freezing. And it was enough of a flow that within 2 to 3 hours, it would even if you emptied out the hole, it would fill up completely. So,
Jesus.
So try getting plumbers to come out on, you know, a Saturday in the afternoon. It's hard enough, and the landlord He's a good guy, but he wants to save his money, so he's not going to spend if he doesn't have to. He's like, okay, I'll go get a sump pump, which is, you know, they use to pump out that sort of thing in temporary. Basically, you hook it up, put it down in the via hose to your other drainage area, and it will just constantly pump whenever it starts to fill up until a real plumber can come. Because he had already booked a plumber for Monday, like for today.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happening is he gets the pump, goes home, everything's fine. It looks like it's pumping a little bit because we had already emptied the hole. Well, little did we know, he grabbed the wrong pump.
Oh.
And grabbed one, like a little one that you put in like a basement, like you'd bury it in a hole in the back corner of the basement if you had like a little bit of condensation coming in sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So it turns on every 5 minutes for about 3 seconds just to pump a tiny bit of water. And it's all it's meant to do is sort of dry up a little bit. Well, this needed to have a constant, you know, pump working. So we, from 2 p.m. until 1 a.m, we are constantly emptying out water. The new supers, her first day on her job and her boyfriend's job as a super, they're emptying out water for 8 hours. Finally get the city to come out. The city isn't supposed to come into the building to do anything. They're only supposed to check the outside line. But he's, you know, sympathetic to us. So he comes in, checks where it's coming in. He tries to turn off the water, can't turn off the water. At the city's end, the street pipe is broken, like the actual valve to turn it off.
Oh,
because
wow.
It probably has never been they're supposed to maintain them all around the city, you know, every so often they're supposed to go and make sure everything works. But because this is, it's not an old part of the city that I live in, but it's sort of a tucked away area. He goes, mm-hmm. He goes, I don't think that valve's ever been turned since they put it in like 1960. So he couldn't close the valve to shut off our water, even temporarily, just to get things working. So he comes in and tries to bend the wire, or basically clamp off the main line to the building from the inside. Because he figured out where it was. The break was not from where the city comes in through the parking lot into the underneath the building. It's from somewhere between where the opening is, where it was flooding, and the boiler room, which is basically a 25-foot area. But you can't get to that because it's buried underneath the building, right? You'd have to actually pull the whole wiring out. You'd have to do all that sort of stuff. So that's what they're going to eventually have to do. But he couldn't even clamp that. So I'm like, screw this. I am not going to be... I've been up here for like 8-9 hours. The new super's like, okay, I'm going to call an emergency plumber, you know, and they called they finally got through to somebody that would come. They brought a proper pump, and then they brought basically like a fireman's hose so that it wouldn't freeze. And it was hooked up, and they were basically... pumping the water out to the street that would then go down to the like the sewage system outside, like the sewers. So that's how I was no longer underwater. we cleaned up my place and everything was good. Like there wasn't enough time for things to have set in to have done any damage. It was just like, what if you were washing your floors and you put too much water down? That's what it was like. But it could have got much worse. Like I would have gone to bed and woke up and it would have flooded like beyond anything if they had not put the pump in.
Yeah, you got lucky in the fact that this could have been much, much worse.
Well, and the super came downstairs at 4:30 in the morning, like after 2 or 3 hours after the pump was put in to check, and the pump that they had put in had fallen on its side, so they had to pick it up because it was starting to fill up again.
Oh my God.
So after all that, yesterday, you know, if the city finally comes out with a full crew, even on a Sunday, and then they fixed the line outside, like the actual valve, to turn it off so they could properly see what's going on. We had a different plumber come in, and he cut the pipe out, basically bypassing it, and he put a temporary line, basically jerry-rigged it so that comes in from the city into where that hole is, like the normal access point in the hallway, and then he put piping like a super heavy duty, high quality like rubbery pipe hose sort of system, goes up through over the top of the ceiling. It's sort of hooked up to the ceiling and then into the boiler room. So he's bypassing it with a line that's maybe 3/4 the width. So our water pressure isn't perfect, but everybody can now shower, go to the bathroom, do your dishes, everything like normal until they can actually see what they have to do to replace the entire line. Because they can't just replace the one little section. It's an old pipe from 60 years ago. So what they have to do is they're going to have to pull the entire line out from the building, from the street, and put a brand new one in.
Oh, that
so it's going to be like really expensive. It's something the landlord should have been maintaining and should have kept up on, but it's a thing that happens when you got a building, like an apartment building that's 50, 60 years old.
Yeah, and just, unless you know about it, not a whole
lot. Well, and it's not like if this was a downtown building or something, it's a different story because it's a lot easier to access stuff like that. I'm not like way out in the boonies or anything, but I'm in a spot that's not as like traveled. It's not as common for things to have been checked up on even by the city. So right now there's hot water and everything. I haven't seen, they were supposed to come out and do stuff this morning. I haven't seen anybody. I'm assuming it's the weather, because if they have to be doing any assessing outside, they can't, but at least now we've got water. So the
saga will likely continue at some point.
It will. Like if I'm recording with you or something, I've got my mic that shouldn't be picking up any background noise. So if anything goes on out there short of jackhammering, we'll be fine.
All right. So coming up on the show this week, we are going to be talking about some of the latest news happening with Nintendo and a surprise development in a much anticipated project. We're also going to be talking about GameStop fucking up yet again, and Netflix once again bringing more original content, well, semi-original content. They're going to be developing a rather beloved IP, at least by me, into a new television series. Also in the realm of the weird news, we're going to talk about some mac and cheese that'll last at 20 years on the shelf, a unexpected esports league, and finally, Amazon has developed a anti-robot vest. We'll talk about all that and more. Also, for reviews on the show, we got a first up review coming to us from Alex himself from La La Land Records, and that'll be on the Cobra Kai soundtrack, a YouTube original show. And we also have something coming up from Mr. Tristan at the end of the show. Be sure to be checking that out. So we'll be back right here on This Week in Geek. I've been your host, Mike the Birdman Dodd, joined with Alex the producer. We'll be back, guys, right after this from our sponsors of LibrisArcana.com.
It's 2019 here at Twig, and we wanted to start out the year with expanding our horizons. We've done mostly video games and movie and TV reviews, but I reached out and we've started going into the realms of manga and music. And the first release we're going to do for the new year here is the Cobra Kai soundtrack for season one of the Google Premium show, based on and sequel to the Karate Kid series. This is brought to us by La La Land Records, and they're known for bringing back weird, obscure, and sometimes forgotten soundtracks, and sometimes the most popular ones. Like, they have the Star Trek and the Batman the Animated Series soundtracks available, and when they release a soundtrack, it's usually the score for every single episode of a show in a given season or in a given show itself for the entire series. So you end up with a lot of tracks that are usually in the realm of the 30-second to maybe 2.5 minute mark, basically the full length that they would be, and they would be looped in a show or used in multiple spots for, let's say, incidental music, like, you know, to build tension, that sort of thing. And this is something that when I saw the show, I thought this had fantastic music, and I was hoping that there was going to be a soundtrack coming out, and sure enough, La La Land Records brought it out. At the beginning of this review here, we played the opening track, which is one of the highlights, Wake the Snake. This whole soundtrack has a very 1980s hard rock movie soundtrack feel, mixed with the modern sensibilities of recording when we have a little more electronica or a little more computer mixing done to it. But the big highlight of this is that, unlike a lot of other soundtracks and music and rock and roll specifically in the last 10 years or so, this isn't blown out to hell, if that makes any sense. There's that loudness war issue that happened about 10, 15, 20 years ago that pervades itself into society until today, where you take the music, you're like, we got to make it louder so that people listening with their headphones are going to like it. Well, making it louder, there's only a certain point you can get to. You get to 0 decibels, and then eventually when you go above that, you hear either clipping or you lose all of the mid-range and all the dynamic range that you would hear of music. So if you pop in a CD that was well-mixed from, let's say, like anywhere from like 82 or 83 till about 95, you're going to find that they have dynamic highs, mid-ranges, lows, and you can just turn the volume up on your receiver or on your headphones, and it doesn't distort no matter how loud you get. It just, you get the highs, the mids, the lows. And there's always a little bit of ceiling in there, so it never really clips. It never hits a part where it distorts or pops or clicks or anything. And you'll find that a lot of releases that were supposedly remastered, I'm going to say in quotes here, in the early 2000s to now, A lot of times, yeah, they're louder. Maybe you'll hear the bass a little better, but you lose a lot of the mid-range, or you might not hear things you used to hear because they've just used equalizer settings and compressed it to hell so that it just destroys the original intent of the audio. I've gotten around that in the past by picking up a lot of surround sound CDs, so CD Super Audio, things like that, audiophile level stuff, where generally they do a good job of keeping that dynamic range in there, and then you get the surround experience from that. I've also done that with high-res audio tracks, but lately, a lot of times, high-res audio tracks, they're doing the same thing. They're just basically blowing up the audio. Sure, it's in higher resolution, but it's still louder than it should be. This is not the case with La La Land Records' Cobra Kai, the original score. Now, you have, you know, I put this into my computer. I played it through the CD player in my computer so I could look at the waveform of it, and it is fantastic. Like, we're talking crisp mids, very, very, very well-defined highs. The bass is good. It never gets too loud. It has enough range, dynamic range, to move, so you have quiet parts that are quiet, loud parts that are louder. And it's just a fun soundtrack to listen to. Now, there's 37 tracks on here, and that sounds like a lot, but it totals about 55 minutes because, like I said, these tracks range from about the smallest being about 38 seconds or so to the longest being 3 or 4 minutes. And what you get are every single incidental score and soundtrack music that was made for the first season of the Google show, for the YouTube premium show, season one, not including any licensed music, of course, anything that they would have used that had a radio song. This is just the score that was produced for it. But it's fantastic. It's the kind of music that you can put on when you're writing or doing some work, or you want something in the background. You just want some cool instrumental rock music. Highlights from this are like the title track, the first one, Awake the Snake. Listening to it, I've done about 3 or 4 listens just to get a good balance of it. I really liked, there was one in here called Slither that was good. You've also got the No Mercy's pretty good. Like, and there's a lot of mixes of the original score from the 80s. They've taken hints from that and little touches and then remixed them. And yeah, everything seems seamless. King Cobra's also great. So essentially you get 28 tracks, and then there's also bonus tracks on here. 29 through 37 are just extra tracks that are in this pressed release that you can pick up from lalalandrecords.com. Highly recommended. The price they're asking for it is good. You know, you're looking at anywhere for a good soundtrack CD now, $20, $25. They're in that price range there. So there's also limited editions on their website. They may be sold out by now, but they come in a long box. If you remember those long boxes for the PlayStation, same size. With some extras in there, but what I have here to review is the Cobra Kai Standard Edition that has all the extra bonus tracks, and it's highly recommended. I'm going to put a little clip here at the end of another one of my favorites here, so you can listen to that, and I can't wait to see what La La Land Records comes out with next.
Need a new weapon in your battle against evil? Check out LibrisArcana.com for Canada's premier RPG dice subscription service for only $7.97 Canadian with free shipping. You can get a new complete set of role-playing dice from D4s to D20s delivered straight to your door. Dice themes are new each month and can be anything your mind can imagine and beyond. Visit LibrisArcana.com and subscribe for only $7.97 Canadian with free shipping, and be prepared to open up new worlds of adventure.
News on the march!
And thank you for that review, Alex. Definitely be sure to be checking out Cobra Kai, available on YouTube Red, though I think you can just watch it regularly now, if I'm not mistaken.
I believe they give you at least the first episode for free, and then definitely check out the album from La La Land Records.
So be sure to be checking that out. All right, guys, so we got, it's time to check out the news that is, that was, and forever shall be burned into the pages of history. let's start with the big one in the room, and we're going to talk about Nintendo. So back in June 2017, Nintendo announced they were working on development of Metroid Prime 4. This would be, obviously, the fourth entry in the franchise, the last one being the Nintendo Wii's Metroid Prime 3 Corruption, which I think was pretty well received, if I'm not mistaken. But all we got was a logo, and it was being read by Metroid Prime series producer Kensuke Tanabe with a talented new development team. However, Nintendo dropped a bombshell on us earlier this week with a surprise YouTube video that appeared on their official channel, basically saying, guys, we got a problem. The current way this game is shaping up, it's not hitting the standards that we want for you, and we're going to send it back. We're basically sending it back. So they sent it back to Retro Studios, which is a developer based, I want to say, in Texas, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, they're in Texas.
And they've done a lot of really good games for Nintendo in the past. So they're going to restart development on Metroid Prime 4 with this new team.
And I mean, before we get into that, like for anybody that doesn't know what Retro is, they were a studio formed by Nintendo and former members of Iguana. Iguana was the company that made the Turok series.
I also think they did Rogue Leader or Rogue Squadron.
They might have done. I'm not sure off the top of my head. I just know that they were the Turok people. Like, Nintendo traditionally hasn't been good at making first-person shooters. So they picked up the company, basically, that made the only good ones on their system. Right? So, because Turok was fantastic. And it was, remember, it was N64 exclusive.
Yeah, well, you can now get it on X, or you can get them on Xbox Live if you have
backwards compatibility, but
at the time.
Yeah. So this, in my mind, news-wise, this is what should have happened since the beginning. Like,
I don't think it's a bad idea for them to go with new studios to try new people just to give other people a chance. But the fact that this has been cooking for who knows how long before they even announced this. Well, I like the transparency Nintendo showing, though. If they say this product is not up to our standards, it's not going to be up to yours. Because the Metroid franchise, the Metroid IP, is, for the most part, fairly well treated outside of that Federation Force, which I don't even know whether that actually came out or what. Well, do you not remember that? That Federation Force soccer, DS whatever the fuck it was?
Isn't it like a soccer game?
Or some weird bullshit. It was something very, very, very strange. And a lot of us were like, what? Now, there was the Metroid Prime 2 remake, Return of Samus, which I think went over extremely well. I know I reviewed it and I liked it for the Nintendo 3DS XL.
Well, the thing is, there's a couple factors in this. One, Japanese companies don't usually, they're not going to be forthcoming. Fault. Yeah, that's sort of... You know, in the society, it's not a thing that they do. Now, it's not a thing that most companies do in general anyway, because they're afraid of how it'll affect their stocks. But what this means is it must have been abysmally bad. Like, we're talking, they're 2 years in and maybe 10% done bad. So for them to go to the American company, it's not like they're going to an outside company. This is a company they own.
Mm-hmm.
But it boggles the mind. Like, you know, I know new blood and as far as like making new teams to work on, it's great. But the reports were they had like several different teams doing different parts of it. And, you know, what was the last time we heard that? Oh, Mass Effect Andromeda. And
yeah, so
any game that has that many studios working on it is going to be plagued with trouble. They may think it's cheaper in the long run. We'll get this studio to do this part. Unless it's like we're going to have one studio do the music, one studio do all the graphics, one studio do the programming. It's not that, though. It's they take pieces and chunks. You're going to do this level. You're going to do this asset. You're going to handle facial animations. You're going to handle backgrounds. You're going to handle this. That doesn't work.
No, yeah, but say, and if it does, not often. Because I know with Mass Effect 3, for example, another team handled the multiplayer, and it turned out pretty well.
Yeah, but it still felt disjointed, though. It didn't feel it was cohesive.
Yeah, basically, you have to have the right synergy, the right levels of cooperation throughout the entirety of the project for it to feel cohesive when it's finally put together into one complete package. And the fact that Nintendo came out and said, look, guys, we want to be upfront with you. I've been reading some of the responses on Twitter and on Facebook and a few other places. People are surprisingly chill with this.
Well, I'd rather it be a good game than be a shit game. And they have this reputation where pretty much they may have games that are hard or a little unforgiving, like some of the stuff. Like Retro also did the Donkey Kong Country Returns games. They're known for being, you know, fairly difficult, but then they ended up doing remix versions where there's easy modes and that sort of thing. But
which even then are still hard.
Yeah, but they're still hard. But they're none of their games. Like, when was the last time you could think of a Nintendo first party mainline title from one of their big, you know, big franchises that came out that wasn't sucked. at least a 7.5 or an 8 out of 10?
Mario Tennis Aces.
That's it, right? And even then, it was getting decent enough praise. But they don't want it to become normal for them to have, you know, less than stellar releases. They're known, their reputation is, our games just work, they work well, and they're always well received.
Yeah, basically, Nintendo very rarely puts out an inferior product. I can't think of anything in the last 10 years where it was a straight up do not buy.
Nothing.
There was maybe buyer beware, but never, this game sucks, don't fucking touch it.
I don't think they've done it since, there might have been a few N64 games that they published on their own that might not have been good, but I can't think of any that were abysmal. I think at least in 20 years, they haven't had any issues.
I don't know if I'd go that far, but I'd say definitely since the Wii, their releases, since the Wii U, there haven't been any releases from Nintendo themselves that have been outright, don't buy this.
Very true. I would say there hasn't been anything mediocre.
Yeah, there hasn't been much. I mean, the only one I could think that maybe was a bit of a cash grab would have been Wii Sports Resort, but that was more or less just a value bundle, putting together all the popular minigames into one spot.
I'm not counting like
Wii Music would be the weakest Nintendo title in the last 15.
But those aren't, like, what I mean by that is, I mean they're titles that star their characters.
Yeah, like anything, you know, mainline mascot.
Like Kid Icarus, even those ones, like the secondary and third tier characters, they haven't put out crap games.
Yeah, exactly. Though, like, I'm surprised certain games haven't gotten ports, but
only thing was, the Other M wasn't accepted, you know, widely accepted as being a great game.
And it wasn't because of the game. It wasn't because of the gameplay. It was because of the storyline. They treated Samus like a bitch.
I get the feeling they don't want, because the last game that came out wasn't the best received game. And that's probably, now that I think about it, the lowest and weakest received game since maybe the Star Fox one that came out on the GameCube.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they want a trend of Metroid games not performing well.
Exactly. They want this to be fantastic. Odds are we're not going to see this until 2020, 2021 at the earliest.
It's probably they said in that, like, when they translated the subtitles, like the subtitles were different than what he was saying. Like they localize them a little more. If you do a literal translation of what he was saying, we're looking at multiple 2 or 3 years.
Which is fine. I'd rather wait a while for a good Metroid game, although it wouldn't surprise me in the midterm if we get a port of the original Metroid Prime series trilogy brought over.
Well, that's what was rumored that they showed. They showed the Japanese team was that they had done a port. Because basically as a proof of concept. And if that's the case, they can build upon that engine and just move from there. But also, Retro hasn't done anything in 4 years, yet they're apparently been full-time. Like, nobody's been laid off. They've all been working on a project. They haven't announced what it is. So I'm assuming whatever they just worked on has been finished, and we'll hear about that. So what's probably going to happen is, you know, before E3, at one of these directs, they're going to address this issue. They said, okay, it's going to be a long time till you hear anything else from Metroid. They're probably going to announce a new game from Retro this year, and either it's going to be the trilogy, or it's going to be another, like, it sounds like they had a new project they were working on. So
we'll probably see something from one of the Nintendo Directs before E3.
Yeah, and then that'll tie us over for the next couple of years till Retro can finally bring up Metroid.
Yeah, so good news, all things considered, all around. Just don't worry, the Metroid pizza's coming. Just have to wait a little bit longer. Moving on to other not so good news. If you're a fan of the Kingdom Hearts franchise, Sony typically does a limited edition console whenever they release one of the Kingdom Hearts games or something cool with it.
Or anything Square Enix in general.
Or anything, Square. So evidently, there is a PlayStation 4 Pro that has Kingdom Hearts 3 crap all over it. Yay, you get a copy of the game, and it's all done up all fancy-dancy like. Now, if you ordered this from GameStop in the U.S. and Canada, well, evidently, you might be getting kind of screwed. As the game came out earlier this week, some people, just before the game's release this past Tuesday, or tomorrow, actually, will be told, your pre-order has been canceled. We're sorry. We oversold it. Here's $25 that you can only use online.
Yeah, which means it's not actually a gift card. It is a voucher to reduce your whatever you're paying for with. It's basically a 25% off or $25 off coupon. So it's not like if you use it, let's say you buy a $10 game, mm-hmm. it's used. You don't get the difference. Because it's not like kind of a, it's not like a card value, right? So you have to spend at least $25 to use it.
It's so unfortunate that, like, because there were people that traded in their PlayStation, their consoles towards this new one, and now they're left without a console.
Well, especially if you've paid it off completely, that's that promise is supposed to be that you have a copy.
Yeah, like that's total horseshit. Now, I know the fault is on GameStop because they didn't check their numbers or they received incorrect numbers from Sony.
No,
regardless, this is a problem that could have been stopped.
They would not have received incorrect numbers.
Somebody fucked up somewhere.
No, they're greedy. They're like, we're going to hope we get more. They're going to get all the pre-orders they can and then tell Sony, give us more because we've already got this many orders.
And Sony's like, no, we only gave you so much, right?
Exactly. They're like, we either manufactured this many or this is all you're allotted.
I'm trying to think of other times I've seen this. I haven't seen GameStop oversell stuff.
They've done it for every system.
Too often?
They've done it for every special system in the last while, but just not at the scale.
The last time I remember there being a problem was when Sony had the PS1 edition of the PS4. You know which one I'm talking about, the one that's gray, right? Yeah.
The 25th anniversary edition.
Yeah, that's the last time I can remember there being ever kind of a problem. Now, they've oversold pre-order collector's editions before.
Left and right. Basically everything.
Yeah. I've never gotten burned.
I was going to say, that's usually $100 to $200 value, not we're talking
$400 to $500. Yeah, exactly. It's just, and GameStop is in a bit of a space right now because they are getting sold off, or there's a buyer, a merger, something's happening next month, or expected to be announced next month. And GameStop hasn't been doing so well as they're closing a lot more brick and mortar stores left and right. And it's not so big a problem up here in Canada. But in the States, I know the situation is not particularly happy.
That's very true.
So I don't know. I hope the people that got screwed by this get some kind of satisfaction other than $25 and fuck off. Cause that doesn't make me happy. So evidently we're going to move on to our last news story. And this one makes me kind of excited. Evidently Deadline has received a very early scoop that a new horror series is coming to television. It'll be a quote-unquote global original, courtesy of German film television production Constantine Film. Those are the same people who are responsible for the live-action Resident Evil series, which thankfully have stopped back in 2016. Now, according to this, Deadline's report indicates the film series will take on the fictional universe of the Umbrella Corporation, which basically let loose the zombie apocalypse. However, the news hasn't included a single director, writer, producer, or actor, included in this project. So Resident Evil, basically coming to TV isn't a terrible idea. However, that being said, the movies are not a good template. The first movie was okay. The second movie got ridiculous. And then after that, it was a big middle finger to everybody in the franchise who followed the game's lore. And you can call me an asshole, call me a purist, because I used to know the Resident Evil lore inside and out, and then it got all sorts of goofy and ridiculous. But I think it could be done right if they maybe focus on Raccoon City and maybe have a few different characters working around Umbrella, maybe even... I wouldn't want the series to focus on Chris Redfield and Jill Valentine, STARS members. I wouldn't want that. Maybe cops in the RPD is a possibility, and maybe have an Umbrella scientist.
But then wouldn't it just be basically Walking Dead?
I don't think that's a terrible approach to take, because the Resident Evil has the lore of the monsters, whereas Walking Dead only has walkers. Maybe you could see the development of the Tyrant. Maybe that's the first season's finale. You see the development of the Tyrant and it gets loose. and our characters have to fight it off, but maybe they don't all make it out. Second season could be the Siege of Raccoon City. Then it essentially turns into Walking Dead, but depending on how the series goes, and that's another thing too, you have to consider it. How long is the series going to be? Is it going to be like the typical Netflix 13 episodes like they've done with Marvel? Stuff like that. What's the budget going to be? Because if the budget isn't right, zombies, thankfully, are cheap to do makeup-wise. And because I know Walking Dead doesn't cost a bucket load, but they do a lot of their stuff practical, and CG is cheaper in some ways. But Resident Evil is about the fantastical monsters like Lickers, Hunters, Cerberuses, the Tyrant I've mentioned, the Nemesis. And people, if they get a Resident Evil TV series, they're going to want to see these big monsters on the screen. You're going to want to see Raccoon City, which would be cool if they brought this production back to Toronto for Raccoon City. I think that'd be kind of funny.
It wouldn't surprise me based on all the tax incentives.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of possibility here for them to do it right, but there's a lot of possibility for them to fucking do it wrong, too. As much as I'd like to see Chris and Claire and Leon up on the small screen each week, I think that's the wrong approach. I think if you took some new characters, kind of like how they've done with Resident Evil Outbreak and the other survivor stories that you get throughout the Resident Evil universe, you might be able to create some new narrative while intertwining and winking towards those larger events. It's just not to say you couldn't name drop a Leon or a Chris Redfield or a Wesker.
Yeah, just don't give the production to, you know, anywhere near Paul W.S. Anderson or anybody in his team, because he just destroyed the entire franchise last time.
Well, that's another thing, too. I mean, as much as I like the first two Resident Evil movies, Mila Jovovich should not be involved in this. If you want to reference her character... Then, I'm kind of cringy at that, because I don't... Those movies, they took the lore and they spun it on its head.
Well, here's the thing. She's terrible. The only reason she was in them is because she's married to the director.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I liked her in the first two movies.
I would say come at me, bro, but that's really the reason. It's like, her husband is the producer and director of every film, so she's the star.
I'm trying to remember what... The movie I've truly enjoyed her in was The Fifth Element, and I'm trying to think of anything else.
The Messenger is pretty good.
Yeah, so there's maybe three movies in 20 years. Four if I count the first two Resident Evils. So four movies in 20 years. That's not a resume that impresses me anymore. As attractive and talented as you may be, just no. The scripts behind you are crap. So I want to know who's going to be the showrunner for this. I want to know who's going to be the writer.
Give it to like Del Toro or somebody.
You need to give it to someone who respects Resident Evil, but also knows how to update it for modern times. Because the Resident Evil storyline, as awesome as I think it is, it's cheesy as fuck. It really is. So you got to make sure you're balancing between bringing in new fans of the series, old fans of the series, and finding a way to make kind of this happy Resident Evil sandwich.
If it's Toronto they're going to film in, I wouldn't be surprised if they go with Jay Firestone. He's the guy that was the producer for, like, La Femme Nikita and a bunch of more recent, like, Lost Girl. He had a lot of those 90s and early 2000s action special effects. Like, he did Mutant X, that sort of stuff. I wouldn't be surprised if they're keeping the sort of cheesy, campy nature if they go with him.
Yeah, I mean, that, honestly, I was going to say, if the guy who did Lost Girl got involved, I could see that working. So we'll have to wait and see. It's very, very early. This is even getting developed. Well, we probably won't hear any more about it for at least until probably later on this year or closer to next year's upfronts, when Netflix will probably have a lot more money, because I imagine this year's upfronts, the money's already gone. So we'll have to wait and see. But anyway, guys, that's what happened in the world of news this week. So we'll be back right here on the show with the weird news. You've been listening to Twig, the Flagship of Stupidity. I've been Mike the Birdman Dodd, joined with Alex the producer. We'll be back, guys, right after this.
What makes you qualified to be a reporter?
I'm willing to violate anyone's privacy for my personal gain and then claim with a straight face that the public has a right to know.
By the hand of Zeus, what manner of deviltry is this?
I love fake alien poop day.
And welcome back to Twig, and here we're going to talk about the weird news that invades your brain like a fungus, or that brain-eating amoeba sometimes you run into it in the summertime. Nigerius fowli, don't fuck with it. Anyway, This is something that I found amazing. So evidently, if you're into building a doomsday bunker, you're going to want to stock this thing with food and water and all sorts of other survival supplies. Well, what if I told you, Alex, that there is a mac and cheese bucket with a 20-year shelf life? Would that be something you'd be into?
I thought all mac and cheese had, or is it like pre-cooked?
No, what it is 6 30-serving resealable pouches of cheddar sauce mix and 6 30-serving resealable pouches of elbow pasta stored separately and packed in airtight bags.
I mean,
guess how much this bucket weighs?
Wait, so 30 times 6 packages?
Yeah.
100 pounds?
23 pounds.
Oh, okay.
So it's will serve up to 180 servings.
Okay, so I was under the impression, like in my brain, I thought it was like basically a pallet, like an actual.
No, this is a bucket you can buy. It looks like those buckets you buy cleaning supplies in.
Oh, and
you
so can it's like buy a big pail. Okay.
Yeah. It's a huge pail. You can buy it from Amazon and Costco that has an alleged shelf life of up to 20 years.
I was going to say normal ones are, I think, 3 or 4 years because of the cardboard that they use. But if these are in like
plastic vacuum, and air sealed bags,
you know, yeah, vacuum sealed plastic. And then instead of a tub that keeps sealed, as long as moisture doesn't get in, that doesn't surprise me.
Now, I actually said this. I actually have a small story with this one. This story is technically a few months old, but it's only recently sold out. I found out about this around Christmas time. And I asked my sister, Kara, she's like, Mike, what do you want for your birthday? And I showed her a picture of this. And she's like, no, I'm not buying you a 23-pound bucket of mac and cheese. I'm thinking, but think of the value.
It's basically just feeding yourself sugar carbs the entire time.
I will be ready for the inevitable apocalypse.
But that's 23 pounds that turns directly into 23 pounds of fat.
Damn it. But still, I was actually rather impressed because the mac and cheese doesn't look that bad. Now I haven't looked this thing up on YouTube yet, but I will.
Somebody on there that makes all of it and tries to eat it all at once.
Oh my God, that's so gross. I'm curious, but gross. Now, as a side note to this story, I've got this story from InsideEdition.com. Think of that what you will. And for some reason, there's an advertisement on this webpage, and I can't get past it. It's got this little blonde woman. She's probably weighing maybe 120, 130 pounds at max. And for some reason, this is a news story, and it says, woman devours 2-foot-long cheesesteaks in honor of Eagles Super Bowl bid. And I just have to ask you but one question. Who the fuck cares?
Well, you say that, and I'm thinking, like, the only way this could be really impressive is if what it was accompanied with was in one bite each. Like, she swallowed it like a duck, and it went down, like you could see her neck expand, and she swallowed the whole thing. Or,
I was gonna say, maybe.
Or, if they're like, she ate 2-foot-long Philly cheesesteaks sandwiches in 12 seconds.
Yeah, but it's like, unless she did it under competitive eating like rules, or she did some weird animal trick or something. You know what I mean? This is not fucking news.
Or you find out she's like 3'2".
She ate half her body weight in cheesesteaks. Then I'm impressed.
Like, it's like if they're like, she ate her height in subs. You know what I mean? Like when somebody buys one of those 6-foot subs and they're like, I ate the whole thing. And you're like, yeah, so like in 20 minutes. And you're like, what?
See, then it's impressive, but this is just...
like there's no room. How does what are you, a TARDIS, like bigger on the inside, or
oh, it just blows my fucking mind. Coming on to my next story for the weird news, this one was sent in to us by Tristan, who was unfortunately not able to join us this week, but this one kind of strikes a chord with me because I love esports and all things Call of Duty and Halo and Street Fighter. This one is just why. So evidently, Giant Software announced last week it's going to run an esports league for its unreasonably popular game, Farming Simulator. The first season of Farming Simulator League will consist of 10 tournaments and will take place across Europe, and competitors will go head-to-head with a chance up to win $280,000. with prize money being put up by the developer. Tournaments will be held at things like Gamescom and Paris Games Week. Each event will allow teams and players to earn circuit points and win prizes. Once the regular season has concluded, the teams with the most points will gather at FarmCon 2020, where they will take home about $110,000 in prizes.
Imagine the kind of groupies that go to that.
Yeah, so farm girls are hot. I'll grant them that, no, but
that wasn't a joke. I'm saying, just imagine all the hot farmers.
Well, it's so weird because I'm looking at the graphics for this, and it's a fucking guy with like a Thrustmaster wheel, which are really good racing wheels. He's using it to drive a tractor.
You know what, though? Some of those games have shown up on some of the PR websites that we deal with. I have been tempted for the entire year to ask for like Farming Simulator, or what was the other one?
Truck Simulator. They keep pushing that one on me.
Truck Simulator, Farming Simulator. Then there was like also like horseback, but not like horseback riding. I think it's like raising horses or something.
We have a niece in our group. Our friend's daughter, Natalie. I call her my niece. Honestly, I'd give it to her. Be like, all right, you know a bunch of crap about horses. Here, play this game for a week and tell me how you do.
Okay, I know her. She would say, this game fucking lame.
She'd give it with that traditional sass, too.
She'd go, this is fucking lame. Why don't I just go play with real horses?
This is true, but she'd name them like Death Adder or something. If she were to name half of her horses, they'd be all named after vulgar things.
How twisted that kid would be. This one's Pussy Fart, and this one I call this one the plague, and he just goes and kills everything.
If you could make the horses kill each other.
If that would really change the game, and it would probably get a lot more people playing it.
See, I'm curious, in Farming Simulator, can you simulate farm accidents?
Can you farm weed?
You know what? You could probably mod that in. And I wonder if there's mods to like see how your crop does in the larger world. Basically, if you're farming only potatoes and carrots, can you farm cannabis, hemp? Can you sell those to pharmaceutical companies? There's probably things for that.
Can you hoard weapons and then sabotage your neighbor's farm so that you become more prosperous?
And then it all turns into a Waco incident.
It's now just become Far Cry. Far Cry Farmer Edition.
It's the secret Far Cry sequel nobody knew about. But they're doing an esports league around this with that much money behind it, that's insane.
Well, farming is big. And I mean, think about in Japan, how many train simulators they have.
Yeah, that's true. Or how many like airplane simulators, and you have to buy each plane. You can buy different tractors.
Remember how big, not just like there were other flight simulators, but remember how big Microsoft Flight Simulator was here?
Yeah.
Like, there were people, and it was usually older dudes or people that were retired or whatever, hobbyist pilots, you know, former military people. They would go and they would spend, you know, $200 in flight sim, buy all the mods, you know, end up spending like $500, and they would build themselves like flight chairs and all sorts. Like, they would spend thousands of dollars to make their flight sim rigs.
I knew one guy growing up, and this was back in the same era as the Microsoft Flight Simulator. I remember one time he was bragging to me how he flew an F-22 Raptor, which is a fairly advanced fighter jet, from Niagara Falls to Toronto in, I think, less than 5 minutes. And he was telling me about his joystick and the chair he's got, and he even had like a helmet and everything. And I just remember thinking, wow, that's next level nerd. But then again, you think about the rigs that are set up for Forza, where you can sit in, there's gear shifts, there's pedals and everything.
Well, you know, all those DX racers, like, yeah, that's a popular chair to have now. Mm-hmm. Way before that, like, people were rigging and building their own ones like that for flight sim.
Yep, I remember, because they'd have the thing built in the back that would kick with the bass and everything.
Every streamer now has a multi-monitor setup, right?
Yeah.
Well, Flight Sim, and we're talking like 2003, people were using three monitors for Flight Sim.
I remember that.
So, like, graphics cards were improved. Like, yes, they were advertised, oh, do more productivity. Originally, that multi-monitor setups were made for productivity software, like for businesses.
Or video editing.
But the first like consumer products that really utilized it were flight sims.
Yeah, that's true, because there's no point in having it. Like, for example, this past Consumer Electronics Show, I saw someone play Fortnite across three giant monitors. You don't want to do that, but a flight sim or something like this, well, that's what it's made for.
What people were doing was they would have, you know, the left monitor and the right monitors were basically the mirrors.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd have the front monitor be the, you know, the thing. And then like ultra widescreen monitors, flight sims were the first ones to take advantage of those. So I can see there is a market for it. I just didn't realize that the farming market was that big.
It's like I said, crazy. And the fact that there's going to be teams competing for this $280,000 prize pool, it's a little nuts. So
you'd think that they would win a new, like John Deere or something, like a new tractor.
Yeah, but then again, there could be people like us who just really like to play. Where am I going to put a John Deere tractor? So
it's probably,
anyway.
It's probably sponsored by them and everything too.
I think so. I think Intel is also sponsoring some stuff too with it. So moving on to our last weird story this week. Evidently, Amazon has revealed an anti-robot vest to prevent workers from being hurt from giant machines. So the three, according to the Mail Online, or the Daily Mail rather, robot tech vests are worn like a pair of suspenders that are attached to a belt. They're packed with sensors that notify nearby roving robots of their location. Amazon has tested them in over 25 fulfillment centers and are seeing huge successes. So certain robots are used to move things from one place to another, the stocking shelves, to basically keep the warehouse moving. However, these robots could potentially smack into you. There was a story we covered, I think, a few months ago where an Amazon robot punctured a thing of bear spray and a bunch of people got hurt. So accidents happen in Amazon fulfillment warehouses. And this is just another thing to cut down on or to cut employee safety going upwards, obviously to make the workplace a little bit more safe. And I'm honestly surprised the robot's intelligence isn't a little bit smarter to not look for people. But then again, if they're cutting costs, the vests
they're basically Roombas, like they're giant Roombas. So they have sensors on them, but they might get too close before something happens. There's an Amazon focus on this basically entire season of South Park that just aired. And one of the big things in it was a worker gets killed by one of the robots and then they want to revolt. So of course South Park is ahead of the game already.
It's so crazy just to think of how much Amazon has revolutionized the shopping experience, but they've also been accused of quote unquote dehumanizing the workforce. I've got friends of mine who work in Amazon houses and they're stressed out. Some of them are a little happier in their jobs than others. I don't want to reveal their names, but, I don't know, man. Sometimes I think Amazon does some really cool stuff. Sometimes I think they do some pretty shitty stuff. But I think this is certainly a step in the right direction, especially in terms of making automation with people a lot safer. So we have less bear can incidents.
It's basically like protocol number 4 on RoboCop.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I would want one of those vests so that the robots don't kill me when they uprise.
Yeah, you work for us. Do not send so-and-so to Abu Dhabi or something.
Dick, you're fired. Thank you.
Directive 4. You cannot get, I'm trying to remember what the exact one was. Cannot directly
uphold the peace, but something something
uphold the law, protect
the
innocent.
The fourth one was you may not take any action against a senior member of OCP.
Yep, that's it. Brilliant. Man, I need to watch RoboCop again. But that's something that you should do if you had some extra time this week. However, that's what we're not going to do right now, is we throw things over to Satan's Pantry and our good old friend Tristan as he gives us his review of Dragon Rushes. We'll be back right here on This Week in Geek as we end things out here on Twig. We'll be back, guys, right after this.
Welcome to hell.
You wouldn't serve it to a pig. It's inedible.
Welcome back to Satan's Pantry, where we decided to take a look at what happens in the international aisle of your local grocery store, perhaps your big box retailer, or perhaps that weird little store that you decide to go to because, hey, you really want a drink, and you're not quite sure what the hell is that.
Or maybe you found it on the back of the bus.
It wasn't the back of the bus. It was the middle of the bus. There's nothing wrong with bus chips. Well, except when you find gum in them. That might have happened to somebody once.
Who may or may not be on this show.
Who may or may not have realized he had an eating problem after he ate bus chips.
Speaking of eating problems, it's Satan's pantry time. What does that mean? We're going to try something weird and fucked up, folks.
All right, what do we got this time? It's right close to
me. Spin the wheel of whatever the hell we're eating.
Deep Ridge for her pleasure. Wait, that's for later. No.
That's not Satan's pantry. That's Satan's something.
I guess it could be Satan's pantry.
Satan's boudoir.
Satan's panty. Deep Ridge Lay's potato chips. Spicy chicken.
Okay, weird.
It's also one of the expensive ones from TNT.
Are they potato chips like last time?
Wait, are these from... These ones aren't Chinese.
Are they from Korea or something?
No, they're... Well, like, Taiwan, depending on who I say that to, that might... That could set off somebody, because either Taiwan is China or it's not, depending on who you ask.
All right.
It's from Taiwan.
Well, it's from Taiwan. Do with that what you will.
Yes. Let's see. Is it good for you? Of course it's not good for you.
They're chips. They're Deep Ridge Lay's.
3 grams of protein.
I'm a little worried.
Yeah. Potato, palm oil, sugar, salt, maltodextrin, MSG. Ooh, nice. Garlic, soy sauce, pepper extract, cardamom. You don't usually see that in chips.
I'm predicting a very salty
chili, chip. Black pepper. There's multiple types of pepper in this.
Okay.
There's six different types of salt.
Jesus.
I didn't know there were six different types of edible
salt.
I
just thought there was sea salt and table salt.
Caramel color
salt.
May contain tree nuts, eggs, sesame, fish, and crustaceans.
Oh, let's dig in.
All right. It's curious. In a very weird... thick bag.
Well, if I get a crustacean, I'm blaming you.
And I know a lot about thick bags.
Deep Ridge Lay.
Oh,
thick bag.
Wow, that's yeah. That's go try that out.
It's deep.
Holy shit, is that peppery? Mind you,
I don't want to sneeze.
Not gonna lie, that really cleared out my sinuses.
That's oh.
Oh boy.
It's got a bit of that Mr. Noodles powder.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
It's familiar.
Getting Mr. Noodles powder out of that. The smell, anyway.
I
grabbed two small chips, not a full handful.
Oh, and they are big.
Yeah,
like
they are deep
ridged. The best way I can describe them is they're ridged chips, but they're...
They're like English style.
No, but...
They're like zigzagged.
They look like waffle fries.
Kind of,
yeah. They're like sun chips, but deeper.
All right, I was digging.
I'm trying.
Wow.
That's peppery.
I don't like them.
I actually kind of think they're okay.
I taste the crustacean. Now they're,
I taste the crustacean, too.
There's a complicated profile of flavors in there.
Not a fan of that one.
A lot of pepper. This would be great with a dip. You got a hell of a
dip. Oh, well, it's if you've ever seen... You know how Ruffles are generally very thin ridges? And then you get the no-name brand chips that are a little bit bigger? These are even wavier.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's weird.
And they're thicker. They're like if you got thick cut they're like homemade chips.
Yeah, kind of like if you bought them at like a restaurant or something.
I'm surprised Lay's doesn't have that texture here for something.
It's
weird. It would be good for dipping simply because of the shape.
I don't taste the chicken, I taste the pepper.
Replace, and it's not even really spicy. It is peppery
it has some
chicken.
Bite.
Yeah.
Replace that flavor with the regular Lay's barbecue or the... What do they call it? Country barbecue?
Yeah. Barbecue or whatever.
Yeah, replace
right?
it with a normal barbecue or plain and then have a really good dip.
Yeah.
I will say this about them. Really peppery. You can taste the chicken in the aftertaste.
But not overly spicy. Like my tongue isn't burning.
Yeah. I've got that pepper...
I'm definitely sticking with my Mr. Noodles chicken powder.
Yeah.
It's Mr. Noodles chicken powder with black pepper.
Yeah. I really like it, though. I think that's quite good.
It was okay. I'm going to give it edible, but I would never go out and buy it.
It's one of the better Asian flavor chips I've had.
If you gave me a small bag, I'd eat it, but I couldn't eat a big bag.
Because I didn't like the initial taste, but the aftertaste I actually find okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pleasant.
Afterwards, it's all right. But still not going to buy it.
No, me neither. Not again.
You shit!
Yes, Chef, I am.
You are so shit, it's unbelievable.
Dungeon Rushers on Nintendo Switch is, as you might guess from the name, a dungeon crawler game that relies heavily on genre nostalgia and tongue-in-cheek humor to deliver a simple but classic and entertaining experience. I've been playing a lot of ports on the Nintendo Switch lately, and it's been really highlighting the console's ability to play these games on the go or at home. Dungeon Rushers is definitely a game that plays well in both situations. Playing for hours is very easy to fall into, but you can also have a bite-sized playstation on a lunch break and have some fun. The game is essentially one big parody of dungeon crawlers, with every bit of dialogue coded with humor and genre references. You'll encounter skeletons playing poker, witches hiding in the dungeon for marketing purposes, and many creatures with their own motivations for being in their dungeons. At times it makes you question your motives as an adventurer, but there's loot to be had, so onward you plow through the hordes of monsters minding their own business. Perhaps we are the true monsters. You begin your adventure as Elian, a young boy tired of his daily grind and a thankless job, something many of us can sympathize with. Elian decides he's going to quit his job and become a dungeon looter, and off he goes into his first dungeon. After a basic tutorial, you'll plunder the dungeon and make off with some loot, and so begins the gameplay loop that will keep you playing for a long, long time. The tutorial and explanations of game systems are a little bit underdone, and there are even now some elements of the game I don't fully understand, though any level of experience with RPGs or dungeon crawlers is probably enough to figure most of it out. Your party will soon grow as Elian steps into his second dungeon and instead stumbles into a tavern where he meets Thorgrim, a stout dwarf wielding a hammer, who's also the best accountant in the country. He joins your adventure and off you delve into more and more dungeons. Other party members will join your team as you progress, each a little cliche, but of course layered with mockery of the usual tropes they embody. Equipping your team is very important, as you won't stand a chance if you don't keep your gear up to date. The loot you gain from adventuring is sometimes usable right away, but often better saved for the blacksmith, who will craft the materials you bring him into useful armor, weapons, and accessories. It's worth noting that any character can use any type of item, so you don't need to worry about finding the right weapon type, and can focus on customizing your party the way you want to play. Visually, the game is very simple, but it's well made for its style. It wants you to use your imagination a bit, but it gives you plenty to work with. The dungeons are laid out in a sort of grid, and you navigate from room to room, encounters being marked by icons in that grid space, be it a battle, a trap, or a random event. The random events can either grant you buffs to make the dungeon easier, or debuffs to make your life much harder. The RNG nature of these kind of takes away from any strategy you might be using to complete a challenging dungeon, but they're still neat to come across. Traps can be disabled, but it costs stamina points, and may prevent you from completing some of the challenges you're given with each dungeon. Completing all three challenges in a dungeon unlocks the heroic version of that dungeon, with increased difficulty and rewards, which are useful for grinding when you do hit a wall on progress. And progress is slow. Leveling takes a long time, and it doesn't feel particularly rewarding, so you'll need to grind things out from time to time, which might not be everyone's cup of tea. So if you're in the mood for a dungeon crawler, and you like tongue-in-cheek humor, Dungeon Rushers is sure to entertain. With a couple dozen hours of content, you'll definitely get your money's worth from this game. Until the next review, I'm Mr. Tristopher for ThisWeekInGeek.net.
And that's the kind of show it has been here this week on Twig, your flagship of stupidity, as we enjoy this deep freeze that we are currently in. We are going to retreat to our igloos, our ice huts, and any place we decide where it's just a little bit warmer than it is outside. Coming up on the show this week, I'm working on a review of a Dungeons & Dragons card game called Dungeon Mayhem, I believe. I'm also working on Bandai Namco's Ace Combat 7, which I'm running into a few difficulties due to accessibility issues, if you can believe that. So I'll be checking a look at that hopefully later on for next week's show. Also working on some reviews that Alex left me some RPGs for me to take a look at. Taking a look at Artalsorian's Teenagers from Outer Space, Castle Falkenstein, as well as Mechton. So look for those reviews over the next month. Also, Twig will be at GenreCon in Guelph. I want to say the weekend of the 8th and 9th February in Guelph, Ontario, Canada. There's going to be a few Power Rangers there, as well as friend of the show, Mark Meir. So we'll be hopefully catching up with these guys there, grabbing some interviews and whatnot, and just kind of saying hello. I'll be there, Alex will be there, Blair will be there, and hopefully Tristan and his fiance, Lacey. Other than that, Alex, you've got a Turd or Treasure coming up soon, don't you?
Yeah, I'm still working on some stuff. Some stuff's sort of coming in. I've got a text adventure game that I'm working on, like one of those visual novels. I also have a game called Sphinx that's on the Switch that's very similar to like a early 2000s action platformer puzzler. And if all things go well tomorrow, I'll be starting on Kingdom Hearts, and then some accessories to go along with that, some little neat goodies like controllers and Pixel Pals and whatnot. So I'll be putting that together. You know, if everything goes well and we don't have any crazy weather or crazy problems more in my apartment, then I'll be having a bunch of stuff for the near the end of the week or so, or whatever is on the next show.
Good times. All right, guys. As always, be sure to check us out on social media at This Week in Geek. And also, for some reason, we keep getting tagged, and there's another This Week in Geek out there. And what can I say? I'm going to start a rivalry. We're better. We're cooler. We're awesome. We're older. We've been around a hell of a lot longer. So just keep tagging us, because we'll take the social media follows. So until next time, we have been
Alex.
And I've been Mike the Birdman Dodd, saying be cool, be kind, be careful, and as always, live free or die hard.
Well, that's our show. All right, here's the deal. Every time you watch my show, I will send you $40.
Checks will not be honored.
You've been listening to This Week in Geek, your source for guaranteed nonsense or your money back. Tune in next week for more info and the most important things you didn't need to know. Check out our website at thisweekingeek.net and subscribe to our podcast through iTunes or any podcatcher. If you'd like to comment on this episode, head over to this episode's post at thisweekingeek.net and leave a comment through Facebook Connect. Follow us on Twitter at thisweekingeek.net and follow our Instagram at twig_official_podcast. Social media not your thing? Send us an email at feedback@thisweekingeek.net. We'll see you next time, and remember,
lower your shields and surrender your listenership.
Just when you think this show is terrible, something wonderful happens.
What?
It ends.
I have to go. Somewhere there is a crime happening.
I bid you farewell and good luck, morons. Bye.
When you call 811 before you start a digging project to mark underground infrastructure, you're not just making sure that your dig site is safe. You're making sure that your neighborhood's lights will stay on and that you're preventing gas leaks. Because when you ensure that your digging won't interfere with any of Orange and Rockland's underground gas and electric lines, you're ensuring safety for yourself and your community. Call 811 before you dig, not 911 after. It's the law. Learn more at oru.com/811. Orange and Rockland. Everything matters.
Your home is important. That's why GEICO helps make it easy to save on condo insurance. Because home is more than just a place. Home is where you took minimalism too far because there's only one chair in your entire condo and your only entertainment is one card. Not even a deck of cards, but a single card. And all your guests have to share one plate and one fork, but you're convinced that less stuff means more freedom. The GEICO Insurance Agency could help protect the overly minimalist broom closet you call home. Call GEICO and see how easy it is to switch and save on condo insurance.